and Rebecca Moore, Chair of History and American Studies at the University of Houston. His research addresses issues of race, internationalism, politics, civil rights, and the global connection between developments in Asia, Africa, the United States, and Europe. Dr. Horn has recently penned two new texts, White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela, which is on International Publishers, and Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music, which is Monthly Review 2019. He joins us today to talk about his craft of writing and research and his most recent text. He is the author, Dr. Gerald Horn, of more than 30 books and 100 scholarly articles. He has been said on the front of the book, it says, by Cornel West, one of the greatest historians of all time, a well-learned and appropriate accolade. Thanks for making the time, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good. How have you been?
You know, working like a dog.
Okay. Well, you're always very, very productive. The last time that we spoke, we were talking on your book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism and the Roots of Slavery. I want to talk here in the first part a bit about your craft of writing, and just a few words about the book on Southern Africa, which we'll do a longer piece on later. First of all, what courses do you teach, Gerald, at the University of Houston?
I teach courses on Introduction to African-American Studies. I teach film studies courses. Occasionally, I teach graduate seminars in African-American history in the 20th century.
Those of us in the media, those of us in academia who follow new scholarship, they know that you're always having one or two books that comes out every year. This process of Gerald Horn just being a prolific writer, do you remember the first book that you did? And talk to us a bit about your passion about what you do, Gerald.
Well, yeah, the first book I did was on a study of Du Bois's later years. It came out decades ago. I think that if there's any, quote, secret, unquote, to being productive as a historian, a part of that secret is being able to go to archives, which means quite a bit of travel, which means being on the road quite a bit and spending a lot of time in hotel rooms and, of course, in archives. And that is the secret, if there is one.
Okay. You also have made it a point. I'm reading your book on Jazz and Justice, recently the book on all of your texts. You focus on primary. So how do you decide? You have over 30 books. How do you decide what's the topic that Gerald Horn wants to write about?
Well, there are different issues. Oftentimes, it turns on where I'm located. When I was living in California, I did quite a number of books on California. Two books on Hollywood, a book on the Watch Revolt of 1965. When I was living in North Carolina, and there are great sources on slavery at both UNC Chapel Hill, where I was teaching, and at Duke right down the road. And so I wrote books about Brazilian slavery and black slaves in the United States after the founding of the United States. And so a lot of it turns on that. And then, of course, I try to repay the community that supports me. I mean, for example, right now I'm in Texas, and so I'm doing a book on Texas during the 19th century. And then I have various interests in music and sports, et cetera, and so I try to do books in those areas as well.
Okay. So when you go to – when you do your research – You do a lot of in advance kind of notations about where the material is that you want to get to. So once you get into the library, you pretty much know where you're going. Is that correct?
Well, especially nowadays, because with the advances in technology, the inventory of various collections of manuscripts are online. That is to say, not the documents themselves, but the inventory of what those documents might contain. And so you go online and you look at the inventory of the finding aids, as the historians call them, and then you try to email the archivist in advance to pull the materials so that you can hit the ground running once you arrive at a particular archive.
Okay, hit the ground running. I like the sound of that. I'm looking. One of the books that you recently wrote, which is on International Publishers, White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela. It's a long title there, Dr. Horn.
Well, it's a long book.
It is a long book.
Notice.
It is.
And don't drop it on your toe, because it might break it.
Don't drop it on your toe. Where did this? I mean, I've heard you recently talk about development in Zimbabwe, and we'll be talking later on Southern Africa. But where did this come from to try to get this? And why did you title it that way? White Supremacy Confronted, Imperialism, Anti-Communism, Gerald.
Well, first of all, I had been involved in the Southern African Solidarity Movement since I was a teenager, and now I have quite a number of gray hairs in my mane. And so I had a pre-existing knowledge about the subject and a pre-existing interest in the subject. And the title itself, White Supremacy Confronted, I'm trying to send a signal to the U.S. audience, as I'm always trying to do. I try to write this book so that the U.S. audience can look in the mirror and see, staring back at it, the close cousin of Jim Crow, which was apartheid, so that they will then learn something about their own country and perhaps rid themselves of the illusions and delusions about this country and supposedly how there was this grand revolution that led to this great transformation of civil liberties and civil rights, which would come to news to the enslaved Africans of the late 18th century if they were to suddenly reappear.
What's the scope of the book? What's the scope of the book, White Supremacy Confront? How many years do you cover there, Gerald?
Well, as the title subtitle suggests, it basically goes from the late 19th century, the so-called Anglo-Boer War of the 1890s, up until the election of 1994. But, of course, there's a prelude that deals with the close connections between North America and the Southern Africans, that is to say, the Europeans who invaded Southern Africa in 1652, because, of course, the slave traders of North America who were snatching Africans from Mozambique oftentimes stopped on the way back to North America in Cape Town. So there was always a close connection between these two regions. And then I deal, of course, with the what I call the Great Trek from the Cape Town area northward as Britain, which had taken over that part of the world in the beginning of the 19th century, began to try to move to abolish slavery. And that leads these Afrikaners, as they're called, as they call themselves, to move northward and eastward to escape the remit of London, which I try to draw a parallel with the great trek that I described from the Caribbean to North America, okay, beginning in the late 17th century as the settlers in the Caribbean tried to escape slave revolts and move to North America.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I noticed, which is a question I've actually asked you before, which is something is I constantly search for when I have guests like yourself, is this concept of Southern Africa. I mean, I've heard you talk on Zimbabwe and you're talking on South Africa, but this concept of Southern Africa and what happened to the struggles that yourself and many others were involved in the 1960s and the 1970s, how has that played out in terms of any unity that's been able to stay there, Gerald?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, you have the Southern African Development Community, which, by the way, is in solidarity with Zimbabwe, which has been hit with punishing sanctions. In fact, on October 25th, the SADC has determined that that's anti-sanctions day. At the same time, it's no secret that there have been attacks on Zimbabweans in South Africa as a part of the xenophobia that's arisen in South Africa in recent years. And so it's a complicated phenomenon.
Okay. And before we switch gears and talk about jazz and justice, any key points, one or two things that we should be attuned to as we follow events in Zimbabwe, the overthrow, some might say military coup against the Robert Mugabe government in 2017, and where we find ourselves now in Zimbabwe? What to look for?
Well, I think you should look at the external relations of Zimbabwe. I noticed that President Emmerson Mnangagwa had a meeting with the Japanese prime minister just a few weeks ago. This may have been a crack in the monolithic front that the capitalist countries have put forward with regard to Zimbabwe. I would also look at the internal situation, particularly the relationship between the number one and two leaders, the aforementioned President Mnangagwa and his vice president, Chiwenga, now in hospital in China, claiming that he's been poisoned, his supporters hinting that the president himself might have been behind it. And when the number one and number two leaders are at each other's throats, that's never good news.
Okay. This new book, which I've finished reading, I'm looking on the back there. There's a quote there. This is Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. It's on Monthly Review Press. It's 2019, and Robin Kelly, what does it mean for descendants of enslaved people to create a music embraced by the world and still be treated as second-class citizens, exploited, dehumanized, and subject to premature death? By following the money, the managers, the musicians, and the bodies, Gerald Horn gives us an enthralling view of jazz history from the underside. I see on the back there you also have Craig Harris. Anybody who knows about music knows about the contribution of Craig Harris. You've got Akinyele Umoja. Why did you do this particular book on jazz and justice? Where did this come from, Gerald?
Well, you know, I grew up in St. Louis, which is one of the hotbeds of the music. You know that Miles Davis was right across the river in Alton in East St. Louis. We all know about Lester Bowie and all the other greats that have come out of St. Louis. As a matter of fact, Lester Bowie's family lived right up the street from my family.
Right.
My younger brother, a musician, played with Joe Bowie, Lester's younger brother. So I grew up with the music. I had a pre-existing knowledge about the music, and therefore I didn't have to work that hard to come up to speed
okay.
with regard to this subject.
Uh-huh. You start in New Orleans. Why do you start in New Orleans? And tell us the contentious dialogue at times about the word jazz, from Sun Ra saying it goes back to billions of years. Why do you choose to start in New Orleans, Dr. Horn?
Well, there's a general consensus that this music begins in New Orleans. It begins in the late 19th century, according to the traditional narrative, as soldiers who are decommissioned as a result of the ending of the U.S. Civil War leave their instruments. Even today, the U.S. Pentagon probably spends more on music and military bands than any other entity, perhaps in the world, believe it or not.
Okay.
And then the newly freed Africans pick up these instruments. And as you know, there was a pre-existing musical tradition coming out of West Africa in particular that leads to the blues, which is part of the kernel that leads to the creation of this music. And then New Orleans itself has one of the most fertile opera cultures in North America. And that also feeds into this new music that is called jazz, a contested term because it is oftentimes associated with the bordellos from which the music is said to have originated.
Mm-hmm. You walk us from New Orleans and then you walk us up to Kansas City, Chicago, and your hometown of St. Louis. What are the points that you're making about the way in which that migration, and tell us what period that is, how that influences the development of the music, how that influences what has been termed as jazz?
Well, first of all, you may have noticed in my preceding remark that I was choosing my words carefully. I spoke about the traditional narrative about the creation of the music. Of course, there's another story that suggests that New Orleans perhaps was one of the sites in which this music was born and created. In fact, one theory suggests a kind of candelabra theory. There are multiple sites of creation, including Memphis, including St. Louis, all of which are part of the Mississippi River Basin. And then, of course, there's another theory that suggests that the San Francisco Bay Area, which, by the way, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, as you well know, did not have that many black people residing there, but it was a port city, and a port city seems to be a conditioned precedent to spin a theory with regard to the creation of this music.
here to the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. We're going to interrupt the interview for just a moment. We're going to go back to it. The phone number here is 1-800-439-5732. We have a $500 match on the line. Our total this evening is to reach up to $2,000. We're in the last few days here of the marathon, and you're listening to Africa Today with your regular host, Walter Turner. And I was passed the mantle of Africa Today many, many years ago by Faraha Hayati, under the leadership of Barry Scott, formerly head of the Third World Department. And I've always maintained that since Africa is four times the size of the United States, and Africa, from my perspective, is probably the largest true continent. It is certainly the youngest continent. No one questions that. And the developments that are covered in Africa right now are absolutely monumental. You may note that Abiy Ahmed, the new Prime Minister of Ethiopia, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But you might also note that over the last 4 months, Africa Today produced 2-hour-long programs on developments in Ethiopia and Eritrea. Not bullet points, not short clips, not scripts read off of a teleprompter. 2 full programs, which were later translated and transcribed and put out and shared, not only in the United States, but around the world. And we do that here, not because of one individual, but because so many people support the station, whether it's Brian or whether it's Antonio, whether it's Rod, or whether it's Janine Etter, who has been covering Africa in the morning show, whether it's our program director, Laura Privis. All of us go to contribute this, and Pacifica has this tradition. Give us a call here, 1-800-439-5732. Please pick up a copy of the book Jazz and Justice. I was just jotting down, I wanted to say something about Miles Davis, but I was just jotting down some of the musicians who are mentioned in the book. I think one that jumped to mind, of course, was E.W. Wainwright, and people don't remember the E.W. Wainwright for many years was here in the Bay Area, but he had also been part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee band, which played during the 1960s around the issues of civil rights. He was here. He taught kids. He gave willing of his time. If you want to make a donation in the spirit of E.W. Wainwright, please give us a call here at 1-800-439-5732. He mentions Wardell Gray. He mentions Kenny Clark. He mentions Max Roach and the Freedom Suite as a turning point. He mentions Eric Dolphy. He mentions UB Blake. He intros Chano Pozo. He intros Mario Bauza. He mentions Joe Henderson. He mentioned Horace Silver. He mentions Dave Brubeck. He mentions Art Ahmad Jamal. A lot of time on Art Blakey, on Ray Charles, on Lester Young, on Lester Bowie, on Don Cherry. How many people remember hearing the name Dakota Staton? On Horace, the great, great Horace Tapscott, on Horace Parlin, on Ike Quebec, on the Marsalis family, Miles Davis, on Quincy Jones, Machito. He mentions the Cuban influences. He mentions people such as Dexter Gordon and others. If you're somebody who listens to jazz, if you're somebody who listens to music, if you want to know the story of jazz and justice, racism, and the political economy of music, let me read a piece here, which is from the text by Gerald Horn, which is Jazz and Justice, which is available for a $100 pledge. No pledge is too small. If you decide to call our phone room here, 1-800-439-5732, and you decide to get the emergency solar radio, which, hint, hint, is probably not a bad idea to get now. That's available for $200 pledge. If you want to get the Toni Morrison DVD, which we've been offering during this fund drive, that's also available. I'm encouraging those of you who want to support Africa Today, who listen to Africa Today on a regular basis, who know that Africa Today is a site for announcing events related to the Africa, the African diaspora. We have covered events in Colombia. We've covered events in Venezuela. We've covered events in Cuba. And one of the things that your support can do, it can encourage the station. It can fortify those here who support Africa Today, because we need more news on the African continent. It is some of the most dynamic developments are happening. This is the piece where I was reading through the book where I actually put it down and took a walk around the block. Reading about Jimmy Cobb and talking about how African Americans found it so difficult in the unions. Drummer Jimmy Cobb recalled a time when a recording was slated to be made with Columbia Records. He said, you make a date, then you have to wait at the union for 2 weeks or 3 weeks to get your money. Cobb managed to make a date to record Kinda Blue with Miles Davis, arguably the best-selling jazz record of all time. He received under $500, as he says, way under $500, and would take even a few weeks to get that. The record is still selling, Professor Horn says, a lot of records, he said accurately, but sadly, Jimmy Cobb, the drummer, said, I don't have no money to fight them. They got the advantage there. If they were giving you what you're supposed to get, I probably wouldn't have to work as hard. At this point, his spouse added unprompted, sidemen don't get paid in this business. They don't. Jazz musicians really like to play. They don't like the business end of it too much usually. And the union was seemingly unable to compensate. Thus, redoubtable artists like Lucky Thompson, saxophonist 1924, left the business, said Cobb. He got disgusted with it for too many reasons. Now, that story is enough to set all of your energies back. Here you have an artist like Jimmy Cobb, who is a drummer on Kind of Blue, which most people would say would be one of those desert island classics or urban classics or rural classics, meaning essentially something that you could take and play forever. And if you check anywhere you want to see, Kinda Blue sells and sells and sells and sells and sells and sells and sells. And Jimmy Cobb got less than $500. So give us a call here. If for Jimmy Cobb, give us a call here. 1-800-439-5732. www.kpfa.org. You can pray securely online. You know, Cobb, Professor Horn brings in people such as James Baldwin. He brings in people such as Amiri Baraka into the discussion. But he talks also about this piece here, the progressive musicians. He talks about this record company that was set up by Max Roach and Charlie Mingus. He says, during the civil rights era and the political upheaval of the 1960s, jazz musicians also faced a backlash for their outspokenness, perceived radical recordings and activism. They used their compositions as expression of protest. Sonny Rollins released Freedom Seat in 1958. 2 years later, Max Roach released We Insist, Max Roach Freedom Suite. Yusef Lateef covered and composed African-American epic suite about slavery in the Middle Passage. Prominent artists were involved in the anti-imperialist and the Black Power struggles. Reading on, encouraging you that if you're a follower of music, if you're a follower of jazz, if KPFA has outstanding jazz programs, Art Sato, Last Will, all the names are forgetting me, and they'll come back to me in a second, particularly in the Saturday afternoon program. Give us a call here, 1-800-439-5732, www.kpfa.org. You can pledge securely online. I'm reading a piece here from a discussion about Fats... Horace Mansfield Jr., was the name I was looking for. All of these are great names of people who bring music here on KPFA. Give us a call here at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can go online securely and pledge. That is at www.kpfa.org. What we're going to do, we're going to go back to this interview with Dr. Gerald Horn, and playing this piece from Gerald Horn. I'm not going to look back at who's online and who's not online and how many have pledged. I'm going to give you a public thank you. This is my thank you for supporting Africa Day, for supporting Cape Pacifica Radio. 1-800 239-5732. We have covered, we recently got a plug in the country of the Sudan. The Sudan put up a plaque in the country of the Sudan thanking Africa Today and those of us who are involved with Africa Today for assisting with what they referred to as their nonviolent revolution in the country of Sudan. And we've also covered issues such as development in African history. We had on here Professor Maynouem Pim. We have an election coming up in just a few days in the country of Mozambique, and we will also cover that. Let's take a listen to Gerald Horn talking about his book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. We want to thank Susie Day from Monthly Review Press. As Cornel West says, we're celebrating this evening. We're celebrating Dr. Gerald Horn. If you want to celebrate Dr. Gerald Horn with us, maybe we didn't celebrate Dr. John Henry Clark enough. Maybe we didn't celebrate Dr. Yosef Ben Yochanan enough. Maybe we didn't celebrate Dr. Ivan Van Sertima enough. Maybe we didn't celebrate Dr. Chancellor Williams enough. Maybe we didn't celebrate Dr. Shekon Diop enough. Maybe we didn't celebrate Dr. Drusilla Houston, who wrote the book on the wonderful Ethiopians of the ancient Kemetic Empire. Many people we passed on, but we can celebrate the work of Dr. Gerald Horn by picking up a copy of his book. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Mm-hmm. What were the challenges of African American musicians? I like the work that you're doing in there on in being inclusive about regarding African-American women who are in jazz, about the parts about internationalism. We'll get to that a bit later. But what were the challenges of being a musician? And you have a lot of narratives, a lot of stories in there during the Jim Crow era, during the era from the 1890s up until, I guess, the Harlem Renaissance, if that's accurate.
Well, first of all, one of the challenges is a challenge that basically many, if not all, Africans in North America have faced since we first landed on these shores. That is to say, how to reclaim or claim the wealth that you're creating. And the abolition of slavery in the 1860s did not assuage this difficult, prickly matter, not least because as second-class citizens who were producing great wealth through their musical creativity, these artists, these musicians, were subjected to being produced and cheated, not only by clubs and bordellos where they were playing, but also by record companies, also oftentimes by their managers. It's well known that Duke Ellington of Washington, D.C., that his manager put his name, that is to say the manager's name, on many of Mr. Ellington's leading compositions, which means that the manager reaped the royalties, which means that the descendants of the managers, of the manager continues to reap the royalties, not the descendants of one Duke Ellington. The music industry has historically been dominated by organized crime figures, and you may want to footnote this rise of gangster rap, as it's been prosaically termed, in Los Angeles in the 1990s as an offshoot of that traditional organized crime domination of this particular branch of culture. And organized crime was not an equal opportunity employer, to put it mildly. They were wildly ethnocentric. Although I do tell the story of St. Louis in the 1920s when Klan elements, Ku Klux Klan elements, were seeking to exclude black musicians altogether, and organized crime elements were seeking to include them so that they could be exploited shamelessly. There was a battle royal between those two malign forces. Organized crime, unsurprisingly, emerged triumphant, and therefore black musicians won this pyrrhic victory of being able to be exploited shamelessly as opposed to being excluded altogether.
Yeah, the stories are in Jazz and Justice. I'm encouraging everybody to take a look at it. The stories in there of musicians playing and then having to escape out the back door and jump on the train I mean, it's narrative after narrative. I mean, your research is meticulous. I think the point, Gerald, at which I put the book down and took a walk around the house was when I read the story about Jimmy Cobb and Kind of Blue. Tell us that.
Well, you know, that Miles Davis album oftentimes carries a reputation as being one of the most lucrative albums ever produced in the United States, if not worldwide. But Jimmy Cobb, who played on that album, and is still in the land of the living, by the way,
yes,
was played in the three figures for his contribution to this great piece of music. And I'm afraid to say that this is an all too typical story of exploitation of these musicians, which, by the way, does not really begin to change substantially until Jim Crow is put back on its heels in the 1950s, which allows for more opportunities to arise and emerge for many musicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I have in my notes here, we're speaking with Gerald Horn, we're talking about his new book, 2019 Monthly Review, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. I have in my notes here that somewhere from reading your book, and I wrote down to myself, I said, African-American jazz musicians lost millions, and then I went through and crossed it out, lost billions of dollars in this process.
Well, the reparations activists might want to add this to their agenda
okay.
in terms of reclaiming wealth that was stolen. Because, as I tell the story, these musicians in the first half of the 20th century and the last few years of the 19th century are creating as much wealth as any Africans in North America. And yet, they are claiming a pittance of the wealth that they are creating. And of course, there are those today who would argue that that is still the case to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there at some point Marcus Garvey and the Harlem Renaissance, and I don't know if it's fair to say that that's edging out of Jim Crow. What changes did that bring to African-American musicians and their ability to kind of reap the benefits of their livelihood?
Well, I think that there's a new thesis being put forward that the Harlem Renaissance, this efflorescence of creativity in the arts generally, that's oftentimes associated with Harlem, a neighborhood in Manhattan, but in recent scholarship has been broadened to include the what might be called the Black Atlantic, that the Garvey movement played a central role in terms of the spurring of the Harlem Renaissance, not least through its newspaper, The Negro World, which was distributed not only in the United States, but as you know, throughout the Americas and indeed in Southern Africa and East Africa as well. And I think that it's fair to say that the rise of Garveyism did contribute to a higher level of self-assertion and self-esteem, perhaps, on the part of these mostly Black musicians, which then could impel them to demand more from those who were shamelessly exploiting them.
Okay. Why did it seem, and correct me if I'm wrong again here, that so many of the managers and owners of clubs and Birdland and Prestige Records and who ripped people off just shamelessly, why were they recent immigrants from Russia or from Eastern Europe? How did that work out? Why?
I think it's a result of the class structure of the United States of America, which, as you know, has privileged, quote, whiteness, unquote, and those fresh off the boat landing in Ellis Island in Manhattan had a certain leverage over these musicians. They might not have been able to migrate into Wall Street, for example, but they could adopt and adapt the traditional role of people defined as white in the United States within the class structure, which is to exploit Black people. And so that, it seems to me, flows inexorably from the history and structure of capitalism in the United States of America.
Because it seems as if they were exploiting people not only from the recording of the music and the contracts and then owning the clubs and owning the distribution. And you talk about people such as Max Roach and Charlie Mingus, Betty Carter, who attempted to form their own company, short-lived at times. But they're also plying people with drugs.
Oh, absolutely. This is particularly the case after World War II, and this is where it's important to broaden the scope in terms of political economy. That is to say that we know quite well the story about how after World War II, the United States is quite concerned with the rise of the Italian Communist Party, the largest communist party in the developed capitalist world, and therefore U.S. imperialism cut deals with organized crime figures, not least in Sicily and at the toe of the boot in Italy. And this then led to a tidal wave of drugs crossing the Atlantic. Once again, the structure of capitalism in the United States mandates that you run less risk of running afoul of the authorities if you are inveigling black people to take drugs and buy drugs. And, of course, with regard to these label owners and club owners, they had an added bonus because if they could addict musicians to drugs, this would also mean that these musicians were hardly in a position to object to one-sided contracts, for example, or horrendous working conditions, for example. And so this whole question and association of drugs with musicians flows out of a particular construct of political economy. And so, therefore, you cannot begin to understand what befalls the great musician Charles Yardbird Parker, who, of course, will be marking the anniversary of his birth in 2020, the 100th anniversary of his birth. You can understand how he runs afoul of the drug problem with understanding this larger context, which leads him to pass away in the mid-1950s with the coroner suggesting that he had the body, the corpse, of a man decades older.
Yeah, I know there were some stories, again, that caused me to take a deep breath. I was reading a story about Wardell Gray and also about Chano Pozzo and what happened to their lives. And because the drugs were cheap. I mean, I think you mentioned in there you could get a cap for a dollar or less than a dollar. It wasn't, obviously, it's relative, but it wasn't expensive to be able to continue to apply yourself with drugs. What about the Cuban influences? You talked about Chano Pozzo, you talk about Mario Balza, you talk about Machito. What was the influence of Cuban and Cuban rhythms on the jazz that you're talking about in your text?
And also talk about Fats Navarro, who born in Florida Keys, but is of Cuban heritage and Cuban ancestry.
There is so much to talk about there with Dr. Gerald Horn. I encourage you to give us a call here at 1-800-439-5732. Our goal this evening was $2,000. I haven't looked. I'm going to trust that people appreciate not only Africa Today, but what we do here on Africa Today, what we do throughout the program. If you have an opportunity, sometimes on Friday mornings, Janine Etter has been doing some great pieces on covering Africa and issues. Greg Bridges, who's often here from 8 to 10 on Monday evening, also does that. Horace Mansfield Jr., Art Sato. These are people who are not only just playing CDs, they know the history of the music. I'm reading here from Gerald Horn's book, and this, if you're thinking, well, this Gerald, is he only talking about this period? Give us a call here at 1-800-449-5732. 239-5732. It'd be great to get a few calls as we come up near the end of Africa today. I was looking at this group which was formed, which was called the Collective Black Artist, which Richard Davis and others were involved with, who did programs around issues of political issues, worked with the great Alombe Brath, who was the head of the Paris Lumumba Coalition, coming out of New York. Reading from page 298 out of Gerald's book, in short, musicians continued to be attracted to politics, embracing various parts of the spectrum. The Panther 21, Black Panther leaders and members on trial in Manhattan during the era of the 1960s were able to escape a dire fate because of the energetic fundraising of the following artists. These are artists, African-American musicians who raised money for the New York Panther 21. This was a group of members of the Black Panther Party who were arrested, who were accused of deciding to plant bombs all over New York City. Wynton Kelly, Sadie Walton, Jackie McLean, McCoy Tyner, Elvin Jones, Pharoah Saunders, Alice Coltrane, Groucho Moncure, Freddie Hubbard, Anthony Braxton, Leroy Jenkins, Steve McCall, Leo Smith, and many, many more. Nina Simone was encouraged to do a benefit for the Panthers in New Haven when local people such as Erica Huggins and Bobby Seale were being on trumped-up charges. Herbie Hancock did a suite for Angela Davis. Horace Tapscott released an album in league with the Black Panther Party leader Elaine Brown. There were musicians, if you look at people, Dizzy Gillespie's and others, who said that when they were in the audience that they would see people such as Paul Robeson and be proud that he was there. And they did benefits. There were musicians who did benefits for Marcus Garvey. 1-800-439-5732. I haven't looked again. I have a $500 match on the line. Let me go on with this piece here, but let me say one other piece here as to why Africa news, why news about Africa is important, why it's important to keep this on the air. Those young people, those unions, those community groups on Africa realize that those of you who know about the colonial period in Africa, that this is the moment for change. And if you look across with Nigeria, we did a story on a good friend of mine, Omoyele Sowore, who was arrested by the Nigerian police, is still in detention. If you follow the events in South Africa, fees must fall. If you follow what's happening coming up with the elections in Ivory Coast and Cote d'Ivoire, if you follow the elections in Mozambique, if you follow this struggle, this doctor who was here last week was saying that during the battle in Sudan to overthrow the Sudanese military government, that he only stayed at his house one day in a year and a half, as he was either taking care of people or doing work. These artists, and it was wonderful for me to talk with Dr. Horn, because as I looked through the records I had and remembered people like John Coltrane doing a Tanganyika strut, or looked at people like John Groucho Moncure doing Africa, or looked at people like Art Blakey who took on a African name, or looked at people like E.W. Wainwright. It's very, very important. Eddie Harris and vocalist Leb McCann, and they're still powerful compared to what? Talked about the president and war. Tapscott also did compositions in homage to Bunchy Carter, our apprentice Bunchy Carter, the founder of the Black Panther Party of Southern California. McDaniels also worked with bassist Ron Carter and did things critiquing President Nixon. There were people who worked, Nancy Wilson, born in 1937, was proud of her assistance to Dr. King, being there for Martin's lieutenant, she said, making sure that they were housed and fed, and going to the Justice Department to make sure that they were protecting blacks running for elected office. People who contributed to the National Negro Fund. Some of these musicians, as you found, found themselves in exile, went overseas, and spent much of the time overseas. Give us a call here, 1-800-439-5732. there are many programs that we have not aired on Africa Today that we have recorded. There simply is not enough time. There is a program that's in the can, which is on the educational programs in Guinea-Bissau. There is a program in the can on the Sudanese doctor who was very involved in the movement over the last year and a half. There is a program in the can on Robin Spencer. There is another program in the can on Ethiopia and Eritrea. As I said before at the top of the show, Africa is four times the size of the African continent, four times the size of the U.S. continent, and we'd love to be able to do more coverage about Africa. Give us a call here, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-KPFA. You can pledge securely online. You can go to www.kpfa.org. If you go online, you can certainly choose to get a number of different items. There is the emergency solar radio, which I think you'll find valuable in these periods of when the power is going on and off. There is also the DVD of the Toni Morrison video, which has recently been released. And you can get that by going to our website and pledging securely online at www.kpfa.org. Last week we heard Malcolm X. I think he echoed some of the same things that you hear from people today talking, such as Gerald Horn. Let me give you another clip here as we come to the end of Africa Today, and share a bit more with you about some of the things. I'm looking for a piece here, which was a discussion with Mal Waldron, and another piece. Let's do this piece here on Dizzy Gillespie, if we can locate that, and a piece, etc. In the post-war era, Negro entrepreneurs Sonny Wilson of Detroit allowed Robeson to speak at his nightclub. This occurred in the face of serious threats of violence, which called for heightened security, led by future mayor Coleman Young, etc. In 1949, Dizzy Gillespie was performing in Harlem and found that Robeson was in the audience. Dizzy was so impressed, said critic Nat Hentoff. Robeson told the Trumper, "I would have gone backstage, but I didn't want to get you in trouble." I always remember Paul Robeson, said Dizzy Gillespie, whom I loved. And when Robeson was demonized, he was loath to visit the Trumper backstage. But Dizzy Gillespie instructed him bluntly, "You are me, man. Sincerely, I mean that." Walter Turner, your regular host for Africa Today, where each week here we cover Africa Today on KPFA. The